wanted to do something different this week. And by the way, let me just thank you for your faithful listening over the course of what we've released, 23 episodes on From the Belly. This has become something it's been fun and it's been important. I wanted to tell a little bit more about my own story. I've made reference to it. It wasn't long ago that I did a special episode to celebrate my relationship with my brother. And of course, December is a tough month. My brother passed away the day after Christmas in 2016. And of course, those of us who knew him and loved him are very aware of that around Christmas time. Makes it tough. It's tough throughout the entire year. I think we're all surprised that it's been 4 years. But I wanted to do something different this morning. I wanted to talk about a transformative experience that I had back in 1977. I was a few months short of being 19 years old. I had had a difficult junior and senior year. There were a host of things going on in my life. And of course, at that age, I knew something was not right within me. But I moved fast, and I didn't really have a place to sort out really what was going on inside of me and the hurt that I felt and the shame that I would experience just about on a daily basis. I now, of course, 43 years out, I understand a lot more about my life then and also what took place in this experience. I had a Jesus experience, and it was surprising to me because I did not grow up in what I would define as a religious family, a Christian family, or any kind of religious family. And I mean, we went to church, and every once in a while, it was probably more of a social kind of show up. I think it did hold meaning for my parents, and now that I look back on it throughout the years, it held meaning for me as well. But I didn't have any real personal transformative experiences in church. I also didn't experience fear in church, which so many people have, and that's where they learn to frame their lives through guilt, and that was not my experience. But it did mean something to me. But I didn't have an orientation to think of my life as spiritual or religious. I had had one, what I guess I would say was a religious experience when I was about 11 years old. And I think I had other types of spiritual impressions or insights, or, you know, however that's defined. But those that we remember really, really well, and we just don't forget them. They get etched into us. I had one of those when I was 11. I actually was in the shower, and I felt this closeness of what I understood to be God, something outside of myself, where I felt seen. I remember it as feeling like there were just two eyes watching me, noticing me. And so I had a moment of an awareness of that, something outside of me, an awareness of me, that I was actually an individual. I was a person. And that there was a mutuality of connection there. And it lasted for maybe 10 or 12 seconds. But I would think of that often in my adolescence, but not really think deeply about it. I wouldn't say that it changed me per se, but something deep within me was touched, and so I just referenced that as my first religious experience. This other religious experience, again, was very surprising because I there was no natural path that led me to this, like I had growing up, you know, reading the Bible or having these kind of experiences or having an appetite for God per se or any of that, or hearing about that in my family. You know, we never talked about church. We never talked about anything spiritual. We really never talked about anything in depth. And that was part of what created a context for me to really be struggling, because I had things that were going on inside of me that I couldn't make sense of, and I didn't have anybody to talk to about it. And that's so common for so many of us, even today. I think possibly more so back then, because our parents' generation, they didn't talk about their own lives. They didn't talk about their own struggles. They didn't talk about their own pain. And I say that in some ways in support of them, because they had no context for that. And there was so much hurt and so much struggle and so much loss in that World War II generation that it just was not common for them. And so they didn't pass that on to us, and my brother and I, they didn't pass that on to me. And so I was kind of adrift at sea. And again, my junior and senior year was a really, really tough year. And so I had had a major blowout with my father. It was in the summer of 1977. So I would call it around June, somewhere around there. And it was a very, very nasty encounter. He had written me a very honest and condemning letter, is the way I read it. I know it came out of a place of him being so deeply concerned for me, but I felt then, I didn't have words for it then, but now I understand. What I really felt was, you've been so distant from me, really my entire life. You know, you have no right to weigh in now. And so there was something about my own my own dignity that was really offended by the letter. And I learned about this later, my mother had encouraged him to not write the letter. And I came home about midnight or 1 a.m, and it was my senior year, and I read the letter, and I literally just exploded. My parents were in bed. I went to the bottom of the stairs, and I screamed, I mean, just a blood-curdling scream, "I hate you, I hate you, I hate you." And so it was within weeks, or probably within days, that I left home. And I broke ties with my three other family members. And I hung out with a friend in Elizabethtown for a period of time. And then I moved to Lexington, Kentucky, and things got darker and darker and darker. And it was a time of, it was kind of exhilarating in a way, because it was my first time to really separate from my family. I'd been quite enmeshed with my mother, and really disconnected from my brother and my father. And so all of those family dynamics were part of this feeling exhilarated, if you will, that I was out on my own, but I was not in a good place. I was not in a strong enough place to be out on my own and to succeed and to thrive. So things got darker and darker. And it was a time, now that I look back, it was a time where so much of my behavior was, of course, crying out for love and attention. And I also was suicidal at times. And so it was a very, very scary time. And so that all set the stage for one night. It was literally a blizzard of a snowstorm on December the 6th, 1977. And I drove at about, it was probably 8:30 or 9 o'clock at night. I loaded up in the car. I felt this strong compulsion to go home, not knowing what I would find. I hadn't thought it out at all. And that was very true of my life back then, and not so much now. Being 61 years old, I learned to calm my jets down a bit. But then I would act very impulsively. And impulsive many times it's a negative connotation. And for me, it was a reaction to the need to leave or to move on or to grab a hold of something or whatever. And and I would do it with great passion. And so that's the way I approached that night. I had not thought it out. I just went with my gut. I loaded up in my car, drove literally in a blinding snowstorm. It took me, I think that's an hour and a half drive, something like that, from Lexington to Elizabethtown. And it took me probably 3 hours to get home. I knocked on the back door. My mother opened the door. And I said, I need to talk with you. And she and I went upstairs. My father and I were not talking. He looked white as a ghost when I walked in. I don't remember him looking angry. I remember him looking kind of shocked and stunned. And also defeated in a way is how I experienced him that night. Very low energy toward me, but again, it was not, I didn't feel unwelcomed. It just, I think he was defeated as a father. I think he was holding a lot of guilt about what had happened. I'm sure he and my mother had talked about, I'm sure she had let him know that, you know, that letter was very wrong that you wrote. And I think he was feeling a lot of grief around that. Mom and I went upstairs, and for probably 2 hours, I literally just, you know, I came apart at the seams, and all this conflict and pain and hurt and shame and whatever. I wasn't really even aware that, you know, my mother's sitting in front of me. She probably doesn't want to hear or is not going to be happy about some of the things that she hears that I'm thinking and feeling and things that I've done. And it was a time of great confession. And I think it also represented that, you know, as complicated as my relationship was with my mother, we had a special bond. And the way I've referred to that time in my pre-adolescence and adolescence is, you know, there was a part of her that kept a part of me alive. And it was also that part that, you know, we were too close and too dependent on each other. And of course, some of that was what I was really struggling with. And, but that night it didn't matter. And I just poured it out. And, you know, at the end of this great confessional time, I said to her, I want, she said, well, what, you know, she was very calm and collected during this time, which I so appreciated. She held herself so well. She listened so closely with no judgment. And at the end, she, the end of this confessional time, she said, what do you want? What do you want? What do you need? Of course, I didn't know what I wanted and needed. I knew what I wanted. I didn't know what I needed. You know, I wanted relief. And I said, I actually want you to make a phone call. I want you to call that gentleman. And I remembered his name because... And actually, I looked this up recently. I think he's still in practice. He's a clinical psychologist. Then he was clearly he was the only one in E-Town at that time. But I saw that he still might be in business. His name is John Hannafin. And I would pass by on Mulberry Street. I would pass by that sign, an old, beautiful house. And it looked like a cool place to have his practice. And I had no idea, of course, then what a psychologist would actually do in his work, but I knew it had something to do with, you know, helping somebody. And I said, I'd like you to call him and make an appointment for me. I want to go talk to him. And she said, well, it's, you know, it's 10, 11, 11 o'clock at night. It's too late to call. I mean, we can call tomorrow. And, you know, I since have asked her about this. Why didn't you make that call? I mean, you know, I'm sure you call in, you know, there's a crisis line, if you will, for, I mean, we all know that. And I think she knew that. She said she just didn't feel compelled to do that. And then we just, we kind of had this awkward kind of time. And I said, well, you've had this Jesus experience. I mean, you gave Dick and I these personal Bibles, and you know, there's been a weirdness in the house for, you know, 2 years or so. And I can tell Dad's weirded out by it. And, you know, maybe sometime I'll tell her story, you know, in another mini podcast, if you will, because it's one that it deserves time. But she had had this amazing healing experience, literally physically being healed from almost dying, and it had turned her life around. But again, it created an awkwardness in the house. And I said, so, you know, you talked about this Jesus person. Tell me about that. I mean, tell me about this God experience that you had. I don't know how I put it. And, you know, she was hesitant to do it. And I talked to her about this, you know, just a few years before she died, which was back in 2014. And she said, well, I wanted to know that you really wanted this. You know, this was so important to her, and she didn't want it cheapened by somebody just, you know, saying, give me relief without really understanding what I was doing. But, you know, I think that, I mean, we can talk about that maybe at another time. I mean, I've got some thoughts and opinions on that. I mean, I didn't realize I was making some kind of commitment to Jesus, and I don't think that's what it's about. But she didn't push that. She didn't make that heavy. But that was why there was this awkward kind of silence and waiting time. And I got pretty irritated with her. And so she finally, what people refer to as sharing this gospel or good news, she shared this with me. And not so much about her own experience, because I knew some about that, of what had occurred in the hospital in the days and months after that. But she talked more about this individual of Jesus. And you know, I felt so drawn to the kind of love that she was talking about. And that's what I was seeking. I was seeking to be loved and to be acknowledged and to be seen and to be held. She didn't ask me to pray any kind of prayer. She didn't ask, I literally got down on my knees and in my mother's bedroom, and it was just this almost out of body experience. And I said, tell me what to do. Tell me how to make this contact, this connection with this Jesus individual. Again, I had no frame of reference of Jesus, none. I mean, I had never conceptualized, even by being in church, that there was this personal Jesus or the way he would come to people. I mean, I'd heard stories, and, you know, the minister had spoken, you know, and shared the gospels and Jesus, the parables and all those things about Jesus, but I didn't have a reference point. I'm really thankful that I didn't, because I came uneducated. And so I accepted Jesus into my life, into myself, my heart, my soul, and something happened. There was a lightness that entered my body. I'm sure much of it had to do with this confessional time, this emptying time, and then receiving something back. And I'll talk in a few minutes about how I've understood now what happened to me then. But I will say that I literally walked out of that room feeling like, not so much a different person, but feeling like something had been added to me. There was an addition to me that life had subtracted from me, had taken from me, and something was returned. Something was settled back. And I came downstairs, and, you know, my father, I'm sure he heard, you know, a lot of commotion upstairs, a lot of crying and whatever. And I just walked up to my dad. I just embraced him, and he hugged me. He was not a man who liked to hug and to touch and those kind of things. I don't know if I'd ever hugged my father or been held by him. I wouldn't say he held me that night, but as much as he could, he embraced me. And we sat for a while, and we talked, and it was still snowing. There was a lot of snow on the ground, and it's probably midnight by that time. And I said, I'm going back to Lexington. And this is just the way I was back then. I was not to be held down. Even with all of the struggle and the hurt on the inside, I moved with freedom. And so I said to them, I'm going back. And, you know, they begged me not to. But I think they realized that was going to be, you know, they were not going to be successful in keeping me home. And so I went back to Lexington that night. And, you know, the rest is kind of history in a way. Well, let me say one more thing about that experience. Driving back, I can remember being in the car, and I actually physically looked over into the passenger seat, and I could see in my mind's eye, I could imagine, but in a very real way, almost like I saw Jesus sitting in the passenger seat. So I felt this companionship. And then what happened when I went back to Lexington, the details of my life there and a relationship that I was in that I broke off, and that had been such a painful experience that had led up to, you know, a lot of the rejection and hurt and abandonment that I had felt coming into this Jesus experience was much about this relationship. And so I made some real hard practical decisions when I went back to Lexington about who I hung out with and what I did and kind of the whole party scene and whatever. I rolled it all up. So it took a lot of strength and courage to do it, but it didn't feel like strength and courage because it was coming from a place of deep empowerment. Because I felt Jesus with me. I also felt on the inside this incredible warmth and love for everything. And so driving back that night, and then I made a few more trips, I remember, in the upcoming weeks after December the 6th, and it was still wintertime and it would be snowing. And I would stop, and I would just remember stopping and helping a few people that, you know, were maybe hung up in the snow or something was going on weather-wise with their vehicles. And I just remember feeling I was so in touch with positivity and hope and love. It just was pouring out of me. And so something very deep in me was healed. Well, I'm 43 years out from this deep transformational experience. And let me tell another quick story that will kind of help set up the way I've tried to be really honest about what happened to me 43 years ago. And by the way, every year, December the 6th, 1977, my mother would, up until her probably the last few months of her life, I mean, she would call me on the 6th of December, and we would celebrate together what had taken place. And that was very, very meaningful to me. But I'd never really thought about what all of this said about me. I think I very quickly was taught within a few Christian circles that I started to join, and people encouraged me to read the Bible, and it was all to deepen my faith, but it actually made it more academic and it made it more rule-based. And I don't know what would have happened to my life if I hadn't had these experiences. Much of what drove me to connect with these Christian groups and circles and communities was this new appreciation I had for friendship and for community. And I was very hungry for that. But I never knew that I was really, what I really was hungry for was to experience an ongoing experience of being seen and being acknowledged, and that sense of my own value being deepened in me. That seemed to lessen the more I became Christianized, the more I got into taking this serious and studying the Bible and all of that. So the last few years, I've been in a real battle. I've experienced a lot of disbelief, and I've left a lot behind of what I used to embrace about a Christian life and a Christian faith. I actually tried, I say in quote, I have tried or tried, I'm no longer doing this. I had tried to put a disclaimer on this experience that I had on the 6th of December, 1977. I've been unable to do that. What I think I've been able to do is been able to remove all the attachments to it and all the rubbish around it. And I've been able to just get back to the experience itself. And I've been able to see, and I've come to believe that we have these kind of transformative experiences in many different ways in life. And if you want to talk religious or spiritual, many different religious traditions, people have these experiences. Of course, I had been taught and I had believed they were only for somebody who defined themselves as a Christian. And I no longer hold to that. These experiences are universal. And so I see these experiences differently. And I also understand more about how whatever brings these experiences of connection and mutuality, of being loved and loving back. Now I understand more about what takes place within an individual, and I'll speak to that in a moment. But quickly, a story. Back in 2018, if you have listened to prior episodes of From the Belly, the first episode was with my good friend Walter Brueggemann, and I'd flown back to Michigan to be with Walter, and we went inside of a studio, and that was my first episode. And by the way, I was really, really nervous in that episode. I've thought about reaching back out to Walter. We stay in contact, and I thought maybe we can do round two, because I think that there are more questions that I want to ask Walter, and I think I would be more relaxed in doing so. But that was my first podcast episode. But you know, during that time with him, I flew in on a Friday. We did our recording on Saturday, and on Sunday, I went to church with him that morning with he and his wife, Tia. And afterwards, we went to have lunch before I loaded up and went to the airport. And, this is in Traverse City, Michigan, which is a beautiful area right on Lake Michigan. And, so after church, we went and we sat outside. It was a beautiful day and we had a wonderful lunch, and we were just kind of sharing stories and sharing about our lives. And Tia asked me, can you talk about your story, your story of how you came to being a Christian? And I forgot how she asked it. And so as I began to share it, I was at a stage then 2 years ago where I was really at odds with this Jesus experience that I'd had. I would say I'd come to a place where I was rather ashamed of it, because I felt that I had abandoned myself at age 18. Because in Lexington, I had differentiated myself and said, I'm not going to be under the rule of anybody. I'm not going to be controlled by anybody. Even if I have this incredible need to be loved and whatever, I didn't realize it then, but it really was about, I'm going to learn to take care of myself. I'm going to learn to listen within. I think that's what was driving me to even want my mother to call the psychologist, is there's something broken, if you will, and I want to get it fixed. And I had that primal drive to trust that and do so. So here I am connecting to this whole new sense of authority of God and you know, giving my life away again. And I would hear these messages, especially within that first year or so, about surrendering self and emptying yourself out, and you're to be nothing and God's to fill you and all of this. And it was very confusing to me. And again, it discouraged me to trust, learning to trust myself and holding a sense of self in the midst of me living my life. And so I was always at odds with that. So as I'm sharing this with Tia Brueggemann, I say to them, I had this Jesus experience, but you know, I really am going to leave this behind me. And here's another one of these incredible spiritual moments. Spiritual being defined as something incredibly intimate and close, and you know it will change you forever. When I said that, Tia was on my right, and Walter was on my left. And Walter reached with his right hand and put it on my arm and almost whispered to me, don't do that. And you know, I didn't feel any sense of correction. I didn't feel any sense of judgment or anything. I felt this deep sense of, I need to listen to this. I will say that I wrestled with it since that time. We've never talked about it. We didn't talk about it then, but something got inside of me about, don't be so quick. I don't know about quick, but don't be so quick to leave this experience. The truth of the matter is that what happened to me in 2000, excuse me, what happened to me in 1977, I can't leave behind because it saved my life. And there are things that, again, that I have walked away from, that I attached to during this time of being extremely vulnerable and people telling me how to live and what to do. And now I need to study the Bible and read it all this and whatever. And so, you know, because of really still a lack of confidence on the inside, I grabbed a hold of a lot of that. Really, what happened to me, now that I look back in this time of this transformative experience, is that I had been experiencing a deep sense of self-estrangement. I was estranged from me. I've often said it this way, that there's a you underneath the you. There's a you behind the you. There's a you beside the you. And what I'm talking about there is this true sense of self. And I'm sure you've heard this true self and false self. And really, that's what we're talking about. Well, you know, within a context of a theology of guilt, one is wrong to have any sense of inner dividedness, to have this inner pain. And how that's often communicated is that you've done something wrong that has resulted in where you are. And so you need to correct this by, you know, good behavior or confession or forgiveness or whatever. You shouldn't be experiencing this inner dividedness. Well, you know, within a context of a theology of shame, that's a whole different conversation. It actually invites the appropriateness to acknowledge this inner dividedness, to acknowledge this inner pain. There's nothing that you've done wrong to have this hurt. You have been hurt. And so it really is, it's a non-moralistic context. It creates a sense of being responsible to oneself. So it really enhances responsibility. But often it's critiqued as you're going to end up being extremely self-centered. Well, the truth of the matter is, it's very important to be self-centered, because in essence, that's who we are. So we're talking about the parts of the self, a strong self and a weak self. And these parts actually become in conflict with each other. And this is what was what I was experiencing as an 18-year-old male. I was experiencing this enmity between my parts, my strong self and my weak self. And I actually was deeply shameful of my weak self. It was operating my life. It was controlling my life. And so it definitely resulted in some really, really bad choices. And for me to feel a sense of guilt about that, I think was healthy then and is healthy now, but I was experiencing shame, and that's a different experience than guilt. So the goal is to reconcile these parts. And this is more than just accepting your weak self. Again, if we want to create this kind of a diagram or a paradigm of strong self and weak self, there needs to be a reconciliation between these divided parts. As Donald Capp says in his fantastic book written in 1999, The Depleted Self, he says there needs to be a positive regard for the other self. Think of it this way, that your strong self needs to do something more than just accept your weak self. Weak being as the part of you that's been hurt and that hides and that feels rejected and abandoned. There needs to be something much more than acceptance. There needs to be this mutual connection. He says it, he goes on to say in his book, it's as if I cannot live without my other self, that I am lost without the other. What we're really talking about here is a concept of self-mirroring. It's a powerful and dynamic expression of love and goodwill. It's an event or an encounter of self-recognition as each self becomes the gleam in the eye of the other. So what had happened to me is I had that night on December 6, 1977, I had internalized Jesus. Jesus had become a self-object inside of my mind, inside of me. And this mirroring was occurring. It's Heinz Kohut is the one who really developed this idea of what it means to mirror back love and acceptance and favor. And this is what happens between a mother and her infant child, as this mirroring occurs and the child can see into mother's face and can see the delight that she has, and this mirrors back. And so you have this mutual connection of love, which then begets love. And this is what had happened to me. And I would say that in any, I want to say significant transformative experiences, but any transformative experiences that become significant to us, that we can't shake, that change us for the good, that actually it's in that love, there's a reciprocity of love, that you've been loved and then you love back. And you know, the story of Jesus with the woman who comes into the male-dominated, all-male household or room where she's a woman of the street. She's a woman who has sold herself on the street. And she comes in and Jesus had been invited over to have dinner with a friend. And, you know, it was a room full of experts, Pharisees and lawyers. And nothing against lawyers, but these were the experts. These were the professionals. She was in no way welcomed there. So you wonder, how in the world did she ever get in the door? There's a possibility that she was invited in so that she could be used sexually. And it's in this place that she has this incredible encounter with Jesus. And what I want to propose is the encounter that she had is the same type of encounter that I had. It says that she was so taken with Jesus that she weeps, the tears hit his feet, she wipes his feet, and then she anoints him with very, very expensive perfume. And all the judgment in that room about her and how she's not to be there, and she's definitely not to be doing this kind of act of love towards Jesus. And then the strength and character and the commitment that Jesus had to her deepest, truest self, that he's not embarrassed by this. He doesn't shut her down. He doesn't send her away and then joke with all the males in the room just about how stupid she was for doing that, because there'd be a sense of being embarrassed. None of that. Jesus holds the tension of all of that. It totally, totally removes everybody else's awareness in the room. And he's focused solely on her deepest self. And what does he do? He affirms her deepest self. And so you have, again, this reciprocity of he's loving her. He's looking into her the way a mother looks into an infant. And this is that reparative kind of move that changes the way a person holds themselves. And this woman was changed by this encounter. Another really, really interesting thing about this mutual connection that Jesus has with this woman is that she's so full of love for him, she idolizes him. And it's in this experience that she must have experienced a real sense of trust about who she is. I mean, she really shows up in a very different way to love him. And so it deepens her sense of self. It deepens her sense of the strong and weak self, begin to be repaired. And there's a conversation, if you will, between these parts. So, what an honor it is for me to talk about this. It's beneficial to me. I hope it's beneficial to you. I hope it's been that. You know, Donald Capps says in the book, The Depleted Self, self-trust was manifest in her act of calling attention to herself by bestowing her loving attention on him. She's actually drawing attention to herself. And I find this to be just so, so inspiring, even at this time of year, as we celebrate the birth of Jesus, the one who has led the way in love. You know, one thing I want to say about the book that I'm working on that hopefully will be released, it will be in 2021. We're close. What I have addressed in Jonah's story is that unlike the woman and unlike me, Jonah does not have this experience of being able to get outside of his own story, get outside of this autonomous authority. And autonomous authority is defined as authority without love. And that's how God shows up throughout the story of Jonah, is with this autonomous authority without love. And so we see what happens to Jonah in that place. How depleted, how defensive, and how broken he becomes because he's so out of touch with himself. And shame is so present externally and living inside of his own head. And that's what I talk about in chapter 4, the Bible story, where he envisions all of these interactions with God, and God gives and God takes away and all of this. And the direction I go in my book, Reimagining Jonah, is that this is all the internal conflict of the Jonah is going through, because it's all in a context of a theology of guilt, which is all about moral wrongdoing, as opposed to, if you read that book through a context of the theology of shame, you see a whole different picture of the characters in the story. Well, thanks again for listening in. I hope this has been helpful. And you know, one of the things we've done in the episodes, you know that songwriting has been a real emphasis in songwriters. But of course, we've also touched on poetry and art and authors and all kind of really, really cool things. Music is so deeply important to me. And so I wanted to end with a song. This is my way to say goodbye for now and to bless you as I assume you'd be listening to this on the 24th of December, maybe on Christmas Day. Maybe you're gathered around the table with a few of your friends. Maybe you're listening alone. Maybe you're well into January of listening to this. We've got some great, great episodes coming up in 2021. But I think this is a great way for me to sign off for now. One of my favorite bands from the 70s, 60s, and 70s, Creedence Clearwater Revival. I love the song, As Long As I Can See the Light. It actually sings as an old hymn. John Fogerty he wrote the song, and he stated that the song is, in quote, about the loner in me, wanting to feel understood, needing those at home to shine a light so that I can make my way back. And so I wanted to close with the song. Put a candle in the window, 'cause I feel I've got to move. Though I'm going, I'll be coming home soon. As long as I can see the light, pack my bag and let's get moving. 'Cause I'm bound to drift a while. Though I'm gone, you don't have to worry, no. As long as I can see the light. 'Cause I've got that old traveling bone. 'Cause this feeling won't leave me alone. But I won't be be losing my way. No, no, no. As long as I